It's such a pleasure to welcome Malcolm Perkey, the award-winning theatre director and playwright. I know, Malcolm, you said earlier that you have had four main chapters in your life. One was Wits. You were also the artistic director of the Market Theatre in Johannesburg. You formed the Junction Avenue Theatre Company, and you are currently researcher and syllabus development and writer in residence of AFTA. And what we are interested today in exploring is the many, many creative ways that you've used drama in all your years in schools. So a very warm welcome.
It's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you so very much.
So, Malcolm, we're exploring the connections between drama and creativity, and maybe a good place to start would be the I Love Josie project that you were involved with, the National School of the Arts. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I was invited by Lane Butler, the then head of the department, and the challenge was to deal with 40 students in grade 10. And I said I thought I could deal with that, which was a bit crazy of me. But I've had quite a lot of experience working with different groups at different levels. And actually, I should say that the Josie project built on a very lovely project that I did much, much earlier called Gandhi in South Africa, which we can talk about after this. But what does this mean, really? It means that there are certain fundamental principles that I try to apply. And the first principle, I suppose, is that the student or the scholar contains a wealth of creativity. And my job is simply to find a way into that creativity by various exercises. And over the years, since the early 70s, I've worked with improvisation to make projects such as the Firetown. And the general idea is based partially on Grotowski, which is that the actor-creator, to quote him, resigns from not doing and makes wonderful things. Now, to resign from not doing, I suppose, is particularly pertinent to high school kids, if you think about the blocks and the anxieties that potentially reside there. So my job is to make a very, very safe space and just throw out challenges. And the school is very close to Hillbrow. Mm. And some of the students that were in the group, you know, walked from Hillbrow and lived in fairly dire circumstances. And so the opening sequence wasn't necessarily going to be the opening sequence, was this young man just talking about the way in which he encountered drugs in Hillbrow. Mm. And he had a sort of slang, which I love to use as well. I love to unlock the slang that exists in people because it tells you so many different things about how they're thinking. And the other episode that came out of Hillbrow was the street vendors selling rotting fruit. Mm. And how these kids had to buy rotting fruit and then either decide to sell it on or eat it. And you can hear already there's drama right there. Mm. And then against that, there was another sequence that was based on the scholars, let's call them scholars, the students, the actors, the creators, their favorite television shows. So we got them each to name the shows that they loved. And then all I did was I said, you know, I was trying to make quick solutions to creating pieces. So I'd say to the students, you have to run to the front of the stage or the imaginary stage, and then you have to strike a pose as beautifully and wildly as you can and just shout out the name of the television program. And that became a sequence in itself because it was so interesting to hear 40 different TV programs and what they liked and didn't like and so on. Mm. And then, you know, the next part of that would be, say, to ask them to make their physical gesture somehow reflect back on the TV show. Those are the kinds of games we used to play.
That sounds fascinating. I mean, actually, I'm quite stimulated. I would quite like to be in that class. It's amazing.
And it's so simple. And let me go right back where I started teaching at Wits. It was very fashionable to talk a lot about DIE and TIE, drama education, theatre education. And it's my rather, I want to even say autistic way to refuse those kinds of boundaries. So I had terrible fights in the School of Dramatic Art about these distinctions that people wanted to make. I just wanted to make wonderful theatre based on what the makers could make. And, you know, the idea that there's a distinction to be made and you have to follow the boundaries and you have to follow the law and the philosophy is just not my way. And I think that's probably what's given me a very, very diverse and creative life.
Well, that's really wonderful, Malcolm. What strikes me is that, from what you've said, is that you see drama in life all around us. And,
absolutely.
And what you're doing is you're allowing kids to, well, kids particularly, but I suppose anyone, to form it, to articulate it, to give it meaning, to give it shape, and to own it.
Absolutely. So, for example, in the Gandhi Project, which we'll keep on coming back to.
Okay, you want to talk about it. We're going to get
well,
there.
Well, I know we will, but it's a very big, important source because it was the very first time, I think, that I can certainly remember where I was given this chance to work in a school with very, very interesting, diverse group of students, black, Indian, and white, for example, colored. And there's a famous sequence where Gandhi is, if I remember correctly, visited in prison by Jan Smuts. And Gandhi gives Jan Smuts a pair of sandals. I mean, if you think about the drama of that encounter, and if you put that to 10 groups of 3 or 4 students, you say, come back and show us what it might have sounded like, looked like. We got immediately 3 versions that could have gone straight into the play. Mm. So that's relatively easy. But of course, my job was always to be unusually warmly receptive, which is not my nature, as others will tell you. But in that context, that's very important.
But it sounds like what you're allowing people to do is to have an opportunity to shape the experiences that happen all around us, to kind of own it. I love that. I mean, I'm repeating myself, but I think it's such an important part of creativity. Is it's not just formlessness. It's actually giving shape to.
And I learned a lot of these principles from an early company that I encountered in the early 70s, Workshop 71, run by an extraordinary man called Robert McLaren. And Workshop 71 made 4 or 5 absolutely seminal plays, Survival, Slug of the Reed, and so on. And there were a number of principles that this very, very brilliant man articulated. You work in circles, literally and metaphorically. You work with the principle that any language can be used, which was very hard for me because I remain very complicatedly a monolinguist. But the point was that the idea is to give voice to this group who are in front of you. And he was working with predominantly black actors at that point. And they were, you know, deeply impacted by the monstrousness of apartheid, stealing one's voice away and things like that. So restoring the voice was one of the key principles. So that was a very interesting principle to apply to students. You know, the oppressive classroom steals people's voices away. What one of the jobs I set for myself was, how can we unlock a situation where anybody can say anything? Sir, can we swear? Yes, but only in the context of making the drama. For example, I don't know, because swearing is, you know, they wanted to test the limits themselves. And I was willing to go on those journeys, even if they were sometimes subversive.
Mm-hmm. So Gandhi was in 1983, I think.
That's correct.
If you had to redo it now, these days, what would you do differently, if anything?
Well, I think the truth of the matter is, I don't think any of these projects can be repeated as they were, because there was something completely magical about that moment at Woodmead School, which was a progressive school in the early 80s, already, you know, clearly, as I've said, a mixed-race school in terms of race. And I don't think it's possible. And when I got to the National School of the Arts, I suppose the principles remain the same. The idea of voice and the voiceless, making a safe space, playing games, yoga, and certain very simple games that I used to play in the classroom. And they're just wonderful, because one of them is to have the students find themselves in a box, it's hard to describe, where each of them stand on a corner, and then a number is shouted out, and that number tells them where they have to go. So they either have to swap places in the front or the back, or they have to go from back to front, or they have to go across the group, each of them in a small group of four. And of course, the idea is to kind of make them listen and to respond, but also to try and discombobulate them as best I can. So come back to your point, though. I don't think that any of these projects could have been repeated as they were. And in fact, I won't mention the school, but I did try and do this in a more privileged school, a project where the students were studying drama, but they were in the classroom and it wasn't after hours and they weren't there as volunteers. And they liked to remain upright, both, again, literally and metaphorically. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this work is on the floor. And so sometimes they don't work. And in fact, I went back to Woodmead the following year after the great success of Gandhi in South Africa. And I started a project and it didn't take off. And I just eventually stepped away. So it's not always beds of roses here.
Yeah, I'm sure that is the case. You could never, I think it's absolutely right that you probably couldn't reproduce it. But a teacher like you, and I mean, I could just see in a second your intuitive understanding of what's going on in a classroom or in a teaching space. And, you know, you would, in a very short time, I could just imagine that you'd be able to elicit the kinds of responses that you'd want. I mean, it reminds me what you're talking about of the discombobulation. That beautiful quote, Ursula Le Guin said something about art mystifying the familiar and familiarizing the strange, which it seems that's how you want art to be working, how you want drama to be working.
And in fact, it's I learned that version of the idea, making the familiar strange, from Brecht, who got it originally from the Russian formalists. And so there's that idea has been floating around in various ways, and it's a beautiful idea,
yes.
Making the familiar strange.
Yes. Yes. Yes,
it's absolutely potent as can be,
and that's really what art does and what drama does, and how you know you've spoken about the political power of drama
at its best. Of course, it can also make the strange feel boringly familiar, like people sitting in the front row, as Peter Brook notes, making sure that every word of the Shakespeare is unfolding on the stage before them, and getting very grumpy if there's been cuts.
I mean, let's talk a little bit about Shakespeare, because you did that absolutely fascinating project, the Shakespeare Project, where you sent a group of VIT students into schools, and they spoke Shakespeare to the kids.
Yeah, so let's go back a beat. I'd been working with Junction Avenue Theatre Company from 1976 to 1999. And actually, the mission of Junction Avenue was to reveal the hidden history of oppression in South Africa. That was one of the missions. And then another mission was to tell stories from below. And it was basically an anti-apartheid project, although it wasn't meant to be solemn. It was meant to be serious, but also using humor and political games in the theater, as manifested, for example, in Sophia Town. But after Mandela became president, it felt like the mission was over. But we did one last project in 1999. It was called Love, Crime, and Johannesburg. And it was really, it was kind of prescient because it was about corruption. It was about the secret service. It was based on Threepenny Opera, but we played games with it. We wrote music for it and so on. After that project closed, I decided that I couldn't make any more of those kinds of plays. So I thought I must give myself a real challenge. And what could be more complicated and difficult than to try to make South African students stage Shakespeare's that were genuinely available to scholars? And, you know, the question of Shakespeare is a very complicated one in the schools. Is it part of the colonial project? It certainly was used against people like myself when I studied English at WITS, you know. I remember one professor saying, no, we don't want to see productions of Shakespeare because we can make much better productions in our head. I just think that's silly, because if there was anything brilliant about Shakespeare is that he wrote for the stage. It was so obviously that. I mean, I'm not denigrating or the actual meaning of these extraordinary works. But, I mean, at one level, you know, there's a donkey on the stage, you know, trying to have sex with a queen and snorting and hee-hawing as if he's having orgasms. I mean, what on earth are we supposed to do with all of that? So So I was going to do five product. Well, I said I'd do a Shakespeare a year and start off with the set works. But again, using Peter Brook's principles, I wanted to take these actors into the schools where their audiences were just when they were off book, but when they were still fragile in their learning. And the idea is that Peter Brook took his actors into various institutions, schools and mental asylums and so on, and the actors had to make meaning when they were hardly off book. So the same principle applied. And the way I started these projects was with sonnet studies. And the students, many of them black, in this is the early 2000s, start by studying sonnets. And the interesting thing about second language speakers, unlike first language speakers, is all words are strange. Whereas first language speakers treat sonnets as, what's that funny word? What's that funny word? So every word has to be unpacked if you're a second language speaker of English. And then it becomes ordinary and playable. So those are very interesting principles as well. And when they went into the schools, they thought they were clear. And we'd stop and we'd say to the students there in front of us, what did you hear? You know, the nurse and Juliet. Zero. Play it again. Work harder for the meaning. And within about an hour, they would say the audience could get about 50%. So that was in early stage of rehearsal. So once we started that game, and pushed it and pushed it and pushed it, we were able to stage productions where, I promise, the audiences were getting everything. And I wouldn't rewrite, I might edit, but if there was a word that was absolutely unintelligible for a modern audience, I would happily rewrite it.
I mean, that's a fascinating project. You've spoken, earlier you spoke about your interest in language and slang, and it seems that in a country, multilingual country, that what we all are doing is interpreting all the time.
Yes.
So this exercise is something that we need to be doing all the time.
Yes. And
all of us.
But I suppose, but that probably pertains all over the world under all conditions, but we have our own particular conditions in South Africa.
We do.
And they're mostly wonderful conditions, even if they're challenging, difficult, etc. And for example, I cast Bottom as a black woman. And she was fantastic. I mean, she came onto the stage when she was turning into a donkey, sort of like loping in. And when she did her seductive scene with the hee-haws, I mean, you can imagine how the audiences were going for it. So
it's like that beautiful advert, I love it when you talk foreign. Okay, let's talk some Shakespeare for us.
Let's talk foreign. Okay.
Yeah, I can't talk foreign.
So before I read this sonnet, which I did announce I didn't want to do.
Come on, Malcolm.
But that's okay.
Come on, Malcolm.
That's okay. I can give you background. Okay, so I don't know how our time's running, but I can say this. I always used to think that the British were of a particular genius, and I think they really are, but they've had 1,000 years of literacy. And when I was in America, I understood that there was a principle and a project called the Lee Strasberg Studio, based on Stanislavski, the method, etc. So the Americans had a method, and they turned their method to very good use with plays like, you know, Streetcar Named Desire and all of that. Whereas in Britain, I thought they just did it. How did they just do this? And then I went to a workshop in Britain when I was all full of depression and dropout, and I encountered the principles of John Barton. And John Barton wrote a book called Playing Shakespeare, and he was reputed to know every word of Shakespeare and had it all in his brain. He was one of the great intellectuals of the Royal Shakespeare. I'm not sure he was such a great director. But in Playing Shakespeare, in that workshop, I learned a couple of principles, maybe a half a dozen, that I then understood these sets of principles were the British method. And what's the British method? The British method is to take a Shakespeare or a sonnet, and understand that it's like musical notation, that it's structured into a musical form. And once I understood that, and once I understood what these Royal Shakespeare actors were actually doing, they were training with Barton all that time. That's what made them so extraordinary on the stage. So, sonnet 12. When I do count the clock that tells the time, and see the brave day sunk in hideous night, when I behold the violet past prime and sable curls all silvered o'er with white, when lofty trees I see barren of leaves which erst from heat did canopy the herd, and summer's green all girded up in sheaves, borne on the bier with white and bristly beard, then of thy beauty do I question make, that thou amongst the wastes of time must go, since sweets and beauties do themselves forsake and die as fast as they see others grow. And nothing 'gainst time's scythe can make defence, save breed to brave him when he takes thee hence.
Beautiful.
Beautiful, well, beautiful but difficult to understand, but I try my best. And so let's think about certain things. I mean, there's a whole list of things that Barton talks about. The obvious ones are alliteration and assonance, repetition of vowel sounds, repetition of consonants, opposites. He loves opposites, Barton. So did Shakespeare, built all his work out of opposites. Big words, you know, die. Time. He once uses time as a four-syllable word. Can you imagine? Time! So the very first line, when I do count the clock that tells the time. There's the clock. Right in there. When I do count the clock that tells the time. And we could go on throughout this and see the brave day. Repetition of vowel sound. Sunk. Beautiful, hard Germanic word. In hideous night. You know, opposites. Brave, hideous, day, night, and so on. All the way.
But you're talking as an academic, because I'm listening to it. I mean, I know Shakespeare's sonnets, you know, as well as any English teacher does, but this is not one that I've ever taught or I've had much to do with. But what was really remarkable about that performance is I didn't need to know the words. I mean, everything that you're saying is true. You can hear the clock. You've got those, you know, you've got the paradoxes, you've got the putting together of contradictory ideas, you've got all sorts of things going on, but the performance is a compelling performance of Carpe Diem, you know.
Okay, going. So how did we deal with this with students? We would make them get this. I would have to say mostly second language speakers, yeah. But some, there were a good crop of whiteys in the group as well. And they would work on it in twos, and they would try and help each other to get a clear performance. And each of them would have a different sonnet, each group. Mm. And then their job was to convince the others what they were saying. Mm. And we'd sit in a room, and boy, oh boy, the incomprehensibility starts at, you know, 100%. And then over and over and over, the harder the actor works, we get down to a degree of intelligibility. We do certain things for the high school kids. So, for example, the last nines, essentially, Shakespeare is probably talking to his boyfriend, saying, "Have a baby," okay? Because you know, or he's talking to his beautiful woman. He's saying, "Of thy beauty do I question make?" In fact, probably more likely his girlfriend. And unless you have a baby, you know, everything is kind of the wastes of time.
Yeah.
So when we get to the last two, the couplet, "And nothing 'gainst time's scythe," so now we don't know what a scythe is. So we have to make a symbolic gesture or a physical gesture. Times, nothing against time's scythe can make defense. So then the students can see the implement. Save breed to brave him when he takes thee hence. Mm. So as soon as they see that, they understand breeding means breeding and making a child.
So but it's in the performance. I mean, that's
why the performative element is so important. Yeah, so wherever there's a really difficult part, you know, we'll use physical gestures to try and clarify.
Oh, I love it when you talk Shakespeare.
Well, there we go. I mean, I could go on all day about this one, but we will stop now.
I want to ask you one more question because I think we are running out of time.
Good God, are we?
Yes, we have. Let's talk about Sophia Town and then after that, social media.
Well, the point about Sophia Town is it's a great celebration of making work that is, with all those principles I said, that has taken root so deeply that it's now a national set work. Mm. And that I love that, because obviously as a white leader of a group, making a play that is about the destruction of Sophia Town, that extraordinary, iconic place in the edge of Joburg, full of jazz, music, politicians, the great, you know, Albert Luthuli and everybody else marching through, or politicizing, or getting ready for the Freedom Charter, or whatever they're doing. What was wonderful for me that I could make a piece where the dominant group was black, but there was a nice Jewish girl at the heart of it, and the Jewish girl allows us to have a stranger in the room, and therefore all those principles of drama, revelation of detail, revelation of worlds can play between them. So it's built on cultural clash. But the big principle was that how on earth could I write those characters? I couldn't. But you've got a Ramula Makheni in the room, and he comes in and he says all the Fafi numbers out of his mind. One is for king, two is for monkey, three is for seawater, four is for et cetera, all the way to 36. And that's the first time I've really heard it. I think, oh my God, this is the heart of the play. His name is going to be Fafi, and his job is to spread news around as he goes from room to room, place to place, seeking money to put on the Chinaman's bets.
Amazing.
Principles of the actor creator at the heart of the project,
and making meaning as you go,
and making sense. But yeah, we kept on having to remind ourselves that the core of the play was about the destruction of Sophia Town, not about communication. And so it was all of those other things, but we wanted to and had to make that the center project.
Yes, and I suppose to give voice and to understand the drama and to give voice to the pain and the grieving.
So of course in that 80s period, there was a huge contestation between the UDF, the non-racial project, and the black consciousness. And I was often challenged, and I just accepted that. I used to say, well, I love making this. It's for me alone, and history will be the judge.
Yeah.
But
and it has.
There you go. That's what I'm sort of saying. But what was interesting is that occasionally black intellectuals in the black consciousness tradition would come up to me and say, we can't say this publicly, Malcolm, but we do rather love Sophia Town. So, please.
Well, obviously, it's something that has endured, that love of Sophia Town, because it wouldn't be a set.
No, and it still works beautifully. Yeah. So, social media.
So, Malcolm, the last question, I think you've spoken so much about each person having the ability to create drama, to understand drama, to find drama in the life that they have around them, to see aspects of that. With social media and things like TikTok and I suppose any number of platforms where every single person has the ability to create their own stories, do you think that makes drama more accessible, or do you think it trivializes the drama making? And what do you think teachers and parents should be paying attention to with social media?
Well, I think, number one, it's not going away.
Yeah.
So we better learn how to cope with it. Okay. I think it is a pretty destructive force in many, many ways. Although I do spend all my days on YouTube getting my news in small packages. Mm. Philosophy, introduction to, so 10-minute bits or 20-minute bits. So I guess our attention span has diminished really, really complicatedly since 2 hours traffic on the stage, with the groundlings up front, etc. So I think that's a real impact. I think, of course, also the current politics of anxiety about Me Too, anxiety about identity, anxiety about othering, all of those things mean that I do understand that as much as I wish to hold on some of the principles that have governed my life, they may not function anymore as they did when I was able to really, make things happen like that.
Mm. Yeah, that's a very profound answer. That we use the tools but in different ways and have to do it in an informed, intelligent way.
Sure.
Thank you so much, Malcolm. It's been a real privilege to meet the legend and to have this opportunity for a conversation and to explore some of the really important things for parents, for teachers. It's just been fascinating. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And the little boy in me is very anxious about the word legend.
Fine Music Radio's Creative Teen Talk podcast series was hosted by headmaster, educator, and parent Mark Faulkner. It was produced by FMR's Vanessa Levenstein and Ewan Inglis. FMR.